Welcome to Breaking Through with me, Kristen Rau Finkbeiner, powered by Moms Rising. We have a show of table shakers, justice seekers, and truth tellers, and that is straight from the first guest, Representative Ayanna Pressley, a new member of Congress who talks about how your voice has a significant impact. Then we get the inside scoop on what's going on inside the Beltway with the Family Act and Donald Trump. Then we hear about some incredible wins relating to banks announcing they're going to stop banking the private prison industry and how you can be involved. And then we close the show with some very bad, no good, awful news about the proposed budget that Donald Trump just put out. We're going to jump right in with our first guest. I am so delighted and just absolutely excited to share that we have U.S. Representative Ayanna Pressley on with us right now. Welcome, 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 Representative.
Oh, thank you for having me.
I'm so glad you're on because I'm so glad you were just elected. The Moms Rising members across the country cheered you on as you were running for office. We're rooting for you to win, and then you won. And so we're just overjoyed, actually.
Well, thank you. You know, your partnership in the work, I know we care about a lot of the same things. So, you know, thrilled to be here and to be one of the many moms serving in this new Democratic majority.
I heard there is a mom caucus. For the first time ever this year, there's actually a group of moms who have a special group called the Mom Caucus. Have you heard of this rumor?
Well, I don't know that it's a mom caucus. I mean, that's a... Maybe we should call it that, but there is definitely a group, and we're on a text thread, and it was initiated by Representative Debbie Wasserman Schultz out of Florida and Representative Grace Ming out of New York. I think those are the two sort of founders of that, and it's been tremendous. We talk about our shared experiences as moms, and you know, I'm a bonus mom, and I think, you know, women are moms in many ways. You know, whether you're a caregiver or a guardian or just a nurturer to someone, you know, or whether you are a mom by biology or by bond, as I am, and being a bonus mom to my 10-year-old stepdaughter, Cora, who's been in my life since she was two. So
we cheered you on as you ran for office, and an unprecedented number of women ran for office and fortunately also won. What was it like for you to decide to run for office? A lot of people are looking at you and at what you've done and at the group of newly elected women, particularly in the U.S. House, who are just moving mountains and changing our country for the better. What was it like for you to decide to run and then to run?
Well, let me just say this. Women of every walk of life are leading and having an impact in community every single day. You know, I like to say that wherever, you know, women are in the room, you know that change is happening. The progress is on the way. You know, we are the table shakers. We are the activists, the advocates, the agitators when we need to be, the truth tellers, the preservers of democracy, the justice seekers. And so that's been the work of women, of moms for generations. And, you know, I consider all of us to just be the beneficiaries of that. My journey to Congress begins with my mother. That is my origin story. My mother was a tenants' rights organizer for the Urban League of Chicago. She was also a social worker. She was a community builder and organizer on top of her jobs, you know. And she let me know early on there was a difference between a job and your work. And so she held many jobs, making ends meet to provide for our family. But her work was the work of community building and mobilization and grassroots organizing. And so that's her example is really where the motivation and the education and the expectation really all began for me. And so, you know, this journey has been a long one. I'm not new to public service or to movement building work or to government. I was an aide on the federal level for 16 years, four in the House, 11 in the Senate. And then I served as a Boston City Councilor for 8 years. And now I'm a member of Congress representing the Massachusetts 7th, which is an honor. And I feel grateful. And I also feel the gravity to be serving in Congress at a time when the country is at such a crossroads.
I love that. Gratefulness and gravity at the same time. Speaking of which, You are already leading the way forward in many critically important areas, including you just dropped a bill to give back pay to government contract workers. And you have an amendment to lower the voting age to 16. Yes, woohoo! Yes, on both. Can you share with our listeners a little bit about why government contract workers got left out of being paid after the shutdown was over?
Well, I'm very proud that the very first bill that I introduced was a workers' rights bill. And I did that within my first 2 weeks in Congress. You know, as I said, the country's at a crossroads, and our class is unprecedented in so many ways, including that we're the first class to be onboarded, if you will, in the midst of a federal government shutdown. And, you know, I know this workforce well. I was a hotel worker myself for 6 years. I know what it is to be a part of an invisible, a workforce that's rendered invisible by many. You know, these are hourly low-wage workers, folks that I've been in the trenches with, that I've striked with, that I have been a part of contract negotiations, fighting for them to receive health care, have predictable work schedules, to be treated with dignity, to work at a living wage. And so I know that so many of these families, and despite how hard they work and how critical they are to the backbone of our society and to our economy, that they are often overlooked. And so this was not the first federal government shutdown. We have had shutdowns before, and there's already a mechanism in place for furloughed federal workers, but nothing for federally contracted third-party service workers. These are the custodians, the security guards, the food service workers. And it was my honor to introduce that bill. And as a freshman, to have a piece of legislation that has bicameral support is certainly no easy feat. And I credit the impacted workers for their advocacy, and certainly my legislative team for that. My Senate sponsor is United States Senator Tina Smith out of Minnesota. We have the support of Minority Leader Schumer and 30-plus members of the Senate, Democratic members of the Senate. And then on the House side, we have about 60 co-sponsors. And so that bill made it all the way to the White House as a part of the negotiations for the compromise, if you will. And it did not make it in, but we are still working to get that legislation passed. And we won't stop until we know that these workers can be made whole.
So that means everybody who's listening right now should call your member of Congress and urge them to pass the bill to pay back government contract workers who were not paid during the government shutdown. Now, you don't have to call your member of Congress.
It's H.R. 678.
I love the numbering even. Easy to remember. H.R. 678. And if you live in Massachusetts 7, you don't have to call your member of Congress because she is the ultimate champion of this and many other things. Let's talk about voting rights. I love that you have put forward an amendment to lower the voting age to 16. Right now, as you know, as listeners I hope know, the United States of America has one of the lowest voter turnouts of all industrialized nations. Our midterm turnouts are pegged with a low around 36% voter turnout. We need more engagement in democracy, not less. Right now, as many listeners know, hopefully also too, we have a lot of voter suppression going on, where people are falsely accusing people of, you know, voting when they shouldn't be, when in fact we have the opposite problem. We need to open avenues for people to vote. So what I love about this bill is that it opens the doors to democracy instead of closes them. We've seen too many bills moving forward that close the doors to democracy. I was heartened by H.R. 1, which passed the House recently, and that opened some doors to democracy. What's going on with this bill to lower the voting age to 16? Or this amendment, rather.
This amendment.
Yeah.
This is an amendment offered within the context of our broader effort to advance H.R. 1. I'm very proud that my first amendment introduced was reported out of the Rules Committee, which is an accomplishment for a freshman. And I thank a chairman, Jim McGovern from Massachusetts, who chairs the Rules Committee, for his support. And so it was reported out of committee, and then it went to the floor for debate, and then it was it went to the House floor for a vote, and we did earn 126 votes in the yay, in the affirmative, which is the most that has ever gone on record in support of this. So, you know, I think this is an encouraging step, and we advanced the debate. And although it was not ultimately included in H.R. 1, we again advance the debate, and we're going to continue to push it. I think it's an opportunity to empower and to enfranchise and to recognize the contributions that youth are making in our democracy every day. We are making decisions in the corridors of power and at policy and decision-making tables that will determine the future that they inherit. Since they are inheriting this world by default of the decisions that we're making every day, I think they should have an opportunity to weigh in and to contribute to those decisions. They are already leading on the forefront of movements from Black Lives Matter and mass incarceration and police brutality to climate change, to gun violence prevention. And so there's nothing charitable about this. So far as I'm concerned, this is just reciprocity. And 16-year-olds that I engage with and that I know in 2019 are dealing with 2019 challenges and hardships and fears and threats. And we should match that with some 2019 courage and extend the table of democracy and their access to the process.
I think everybody out there is giving you a standing ovation, even though we can't hear them. I'm pretty sure they are, because that is a beautiful vision. You talked about people's voices, making sure you're opening avenues for people's contributions to be seen and heard. A lot of times people wonder, when they send a letter to Congress, when they make a call to a member of Congress, when they sign a petition, does it matter? Does it matter when people speak out? And I always love to hear the perspective, and so do our listeners, of people who are on the receiving end of all of this communication.
No, absolutely. Members will talk about an issue and frame it in terms of its level of importance and resonance based on petitions and how many signatures and where those signatures have come from, or how something is moving organically on social media, and use a confluence of things as a gauge. Who's calling the office? Who's petitioning the office? Who's emailing the office? What people are saying on social media? So the confluence of all those things are a gauge and inform the level of prioritization that an issue gets. I mean, I think one of the best examples of that is gun violence prevention. And we acted early in this Democratic majority Congress in the passage of H.R. 8, passing universal background checks. And you see the traction that the Green New Deal is getting. I could definitely credit that, again, shout out to our young people. But also it speaks to the power of organizing and mobilizing. And I maintained throughout my campaign that we could not defeat the hate coming out of this White House with any one person, that it would require a movement, and we have to build it. And what I'm so heartened by is that despite the fact that we have to continue to come together because of the daily assault and threats to the gains that have been made, the fact that we continue to come together is heartening. And it speaks to the muscle that we're building on the mobilization side of things, and that our organizing silos are breaking down. I love the fact that the same people that advocate for gun violence prevention and then some, I see advocating for criminal justice reform and sentencing reform. And those people and then some are the same people that I see, you know, advocating for women's health care. And those people and then some are the ones that I said was with today in support of the Equality Act. You know, so I love that our organizing silos are breaking down and people are really understanding that our destinies and our freedoms are tied. And we need to be intentional and inclusive in our organizing and movement building now more than ever before. So it does matter.
Best answer ever in the history of all times that question was asked. That was beautiful.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for being on with us today. Representative Ayanna Pressley, Massachusetts 7, U.S. Member of Congress.
That's right. Who runs the world?
You. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
All right, Sid. Thank you so much.
We're going to take a quick break, but stick around. We'll be right back with our next guest, who is Ruth the Truth Martin. We'll be back in a quick flash. Welcome back to Breaking Through with me, Kristen Rauffing-Finer, powered by Moms Rising on the We Act Radio Network, TuneIn's Progressive Voices Network, and many other stations across the nation. We are on a show about truth tellers, justice seekers, and table shakers. And we have a spectacular table shaker on with us right now, the one and only Ruth the Truth Martin with Moms Rising. Welcome, Ruth.
Thank you so much for having me.
I am, of course, incredibly excited that you're on, because we have to talk about something important, and it starts with the letter T. We've got a double T issue right here. Let's talk about what is happening with Ivanka Trump and how she is pretending to be on board with things like paid family medical leave and childcare, but it's actually kind of mom-washing these policy areas because when you look at the policies that are being proposed, they actually don't help real, live, ordinary, normal humans. You know, what annoys me, and this is on the truth teller portion of the show, is that when it comes down to it, 90% of women make less than $74,000 a year, and half of them make less than $30,000 a year. But the policies that are being proposed would help only those who are making $1 bazillion a year. So, Ruth, let's talk some truth. Ruth, the truth. Okay. What are your thoughts?
I agree with you. I think annoying is a mild way to put it. At this point, I feel like whenever her name comes up, I just sort of roll my eyes and keep on trucking, trying to do the hard work that we know will actually pay off and lift families and our economy up. I think that is my MO right now. It's just a massive amount of side eye and keep plugging away.
So, people, if you see policies being proposed that fall under this area, look at the details. Ruth, can you talk about how important it is to look at the details? Because we have a great degree of mom washing going on, meaning like, oh, 82% of women in America have kids by the time they're 44. Women are 50% of the electorate. Oh, let me do the math. Oh, my gosh, I need moms. Yes, you need moms. You need your own personal mom. You need other people's moms. You need moms in the ballot box. You need moms buying things because we fuel our economy. So people need moms. So there's, you know, this kind of mom washing going on where people are using policies that they think moms will like to make it look like they're doing something than they are already. So the details, we need to make sure that people aren't just talking the talk, but they're walking the talk in the details. And can you share a little bit about that?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. The details really matter. And one of the things that I think the media likes to try to sometimes give Ivanka Trump credit for and is pushing and supporting paid family and medical leave. But the truth is that the policies that the Trump administration has been putting forward and lifting up are really short on details. And the details they do include let us know that it's basically paying lip service to issues that are vitally important to our families, like you were just saying. So, for example, last week or earlier this week when the Trump budget came out, there was a line in there about paid parental leave, but really, really short on details. What we know, though, from past proposals, similar to what was outlined in this budget, is that it falls far short of what working families need. There aren't a lot of details in it, but the details that are there say that it's 6 weeks only, which we know is not enough time. We need a minimum of 12 weeks. Importantly, the proposal only covers new parents, which while it's important to cover new parents, a parental leave only policy leaves out the vast majority of people who need time away from work to care for themselves or a family member. In fact, most people who use the Unpaid Family and Medical Leave Act, which is about 26 years old now, use it for caretaking reasons other than the arrival of a new child. And that's just going to keep increasing as we've got the baby boomers are retiring en masse. We are in a bit of a caregiving crisis. We know that 1 in 5 retirees are leaving the workforce earlier than planned because of caregiving responsibilities. Those primarily fall on women. And so a parental leave-only policy falls drastically far short of what we need to be doing to boost families in our economy right now. And then finally, in the Trump budget, anyway, the funding mechanism for this proposal is basically non-existent. I mean, they're just sort of suggesting that states actually add some sort of parental leave on top of the state-run unemployment insurance program, which is already really stretched thin. And so there's no way to really kind of bolster those programs. And it's just going to leave a lot of people out for all the reasons we've already talked about. But it does try to, you know, give this administration a chance to say, oh, no, look, we are supporting parental leave. It's in our budget, but it's really hard to take that seriously in a budget that is just so horrifically cruel in so many other ways. And then have this throwaway lip service only amount of attention paid to an incredibly important issue. It's more than eye roll worthy. It's insulting. And I think the moms of America really see through it.
I was thinking of the word insulting too, but it doesn't have to be this way. This is my happy moment. It doesn't have to be this way because there is a positive, proactive, awesome, comprehensive bill that actually works for businesses, our economy, and our people, and our babies, and our moms, and our dads, and parents of all genders. And what is that bill?
That is the Family Act, the Family and Medical Leave Insurance Act, which was just reintroduced a couple of weeks ago in Congress. One of our own Moms Rising members was there sharing her story about, spoiler alert, the need for medical leave to take care of herself, the very kind of leave not covered in the Trump proposal and notably also not covered in the recently introduced CRADLE Act by Republican Senators Joni Ernst and Mike Lee. So it's the Family Act is actually, you know, it's the real deal. It is 12 weeks of paid leave for every working person, including self-employed and contractors in the United States. It's modeled after incredibly successful programs in California and New Jersey. It covers the full range of caregiving needs that we know all families have. And it's affordable for businesses. Actually, you know, a lot of small businesses support this approach because it makes it easier for businesses to enable their employees to take leave without putting that financial burden solely on the shoulder of businesses, which is crushing. It's affordable for taxpayers. It's about the cost of a cup of coffee a week. It's, you know, anywhere between $1.50 to just under $2. And it's sustainable. So it's just a real winner of an idea, which is, and it's actually a pretty, you know, mainstream solution. It's not by any stretch of the imagination a radical proposal. So when you've got such a solid, common sense, time-tested, well-researched program on the table, it makes it even more insulting that this administration is putting such a laughable piece of policy in the budget.
Yeah. Laughable, laughable, laughable. So everybody needs to call their member of Congress and go for the proactive policy of awesome called the Family Act. The Family Act was introduced in the House by U.S. Representative Rosa DeLauro and in the Senate by U.S. Senator Kirsten Gillibrand. And it actually is proven to work. It's based on policy that we have seen lift families, the economy, businesses, and, you know, save children's lives. One of the things about paid family medical leave that I think is so interesting is that there's been a march of policies passing across the world. So 177 countries have this policy, and we do not. We're the only industrialized nation not to. And it's also been marching across the United States of America. So some states in our nation have had this policy in place for quite a long time. And I'm thinking about California. And so we have some data. I love data. And the data is showing that when you have access to paid family medical leave, that retention goes up for businesses. Businesses are able to retain employees. Performance goes up for businesses. And they have less costs in recruitment and retraining. So businesses save money. Taxpayers save money because we know that, for example, there's a 40% less need for other government programs like SNAP and TANF, which is food stamps and so forth. And when you have access to paid family medical leave, there's a 20% decrease in infant mortality. So, you know, we're saving businesses' dollars, taxpayer dollars, and actual lives. This is, you know, a win-win-win-win if I ever heard one. And I know I forgot some wins. What wins did I forget?
Well, here's a win related to the Family Act. You mentioned that it was introduced a couple weeks ago, and that is true, but also has a record number of co-sponsors. And now that we have this new House of Representatives with the most women ever, many of them mothers and caretakers themselves, we're seeing real momentum on the Family Act. So it's continuing that march forward that you were talking about, and I think is another win. It's both a win you can attribute to the record election that we just had and just the fact that we've got just such a much more representative bunch of members of Congress who are themselves have experienced the need for leave, both for the arrival of a new child, but also for other caretaking reasons. And they're there, and they're bringing their real life, real lived experiences straight to the House of Congress. And we've seen there was a hearing just last week in a subcommittee in House Ways and Means talking about the need for both affordable child care and paid family medical leave. And we anticipate that, you know, it's going to continue to be an issue that garners a lot of attention. And the good news is we're seeing more and more people talk about the full range of caregiving needs and having a detailed conversation about it. So that is also a win.
Yeah. This bill needs to pass yesterday. I think it's no longer a question of if, but when a real bill will finally pass. I mean, we've got some mom washing going on with the malignant Cheeto and folks in the Oval Office. So, you know, that does show proof of concept that there is momentum. At least people know that this is a policy that is long overdue. But I actually think a real good policy like the Family Act in Congress is going to pass in the next year, two, three. What do you think?
I think you're absolutely right. I mean, outside of D.C., we're seeing lots of bipartisan support. We already knew there was bipartisan support from voters, but also bipartisan support from elected officials. Republican governor signed a really progressive bill in Massachusetts last year. Of course, Washington State also passed with strong bipartisan support. And so I think you're right. I think we're looking in the next, you know, 5 years or so, and we will finally have this problem solved. And that's also good news. There are a lot of problems out there that are going to take a long time to figure out how to solve that are very complicated. This is not one of them. This is an easy thing. We can get this done. We can solve this problem.
I am excited. What should people do to solve the problem? How can they be part of the solution?
Well, they should go to momsrising.org and sign up to get our emails or our text messages or follow us on Facebook because we're or Instagram or Twitter, because we're often on there talking about the need for leave and making pathways for people to be able to connect with their elected officials and share their story, which is the second thing we really, really need people to do. This is the big thing I'm asking folks to do is imagine a time in your life where you've needed paid leave and talk about it. And I'm also really encouraging folks to think about the time that they needed leave that was for something other than the arrival of a new child. And just have those conversations with your friends and your family and your neighbors and talk about the struggles and the sacrifices that you had to make or you know were made for you or that you can imagine are coming. And then let's think about how, you know, it's not an epidemic of personal failings. There is a systemic change we can make and imagine a world where people didn't worry about losing their job because they had a baby or a family member got cancer. And we can, and you know, really hold on to that and make that your motivating thing to think about, because this is something we absolutely can do when people take action and share their stories.
So everybody go to www.momsrising.org and for free, we will let you know when you can pull the levers of change with leaders at the very top. Thank you so much for being on, Ruth the Truth Martin. Thank you for spreading the truth. Thank you for all you do.
You're so welcome. Thanks for having me.
We're going to take a quick break. Don't go away. Next up, winning. More wins are happening. Banks are backing out of funding the private prison industry. Find out what's happening and how you can lend a hand to keep the momentum going and growing. We'll be back in a quick moment. Welcome back to Breaking Through with me, Kristen Rauffingfeiner, powered by Moms Rising on the We Act Radio Network, TuneIn's Progressive Voices Network, and many other stations across the nation. We are joined right now by Morgan Simon of the Candide Group of Real Money Moves. She is a mover, she is a shaker, and she's moving mountains with money and in many other ways. Welcome, Morgan.
Thank you so much, Kristen.
Well, I am so excited, of course, to have you on because we together, along with over 100 other organizations, have had a domino effect of wins recently, getting some very big banks to say that they will no longer fund the private prison industry. And of course, the private prison industry is profiting from our disastrously unfair mass incarceration problem that we have in the United States of America and from our disastrously unfair immigration detention center problem. So this is a big double whammy win, and we're going right now for a hat trick of three wins together, but let's talk winning. So the first win, where were you standing when you heard about the first win, and can you tell our listeners what was the first win?
So I was at home in Oakland, California, which meant that this win came quite early in the morning, and it was that Chase announced that it was going to stop banking private prisons. And this came after literally over 500,000 people across the country taking action as recently as Valentine's Day at over 100 bank branches across the country. and really calling attention to the fact that it's our dollars when they go into the bank that wind up financing things like private prisons that are completely antithetical to our values. So it was really great to see that initial leadership from Chase in terms of announcing that commitment. And we continue to work as a coalition to really make sure that that is going to be transparent and verifiable over time, and that they recognize that this is not just about the recent reported human rights violations in the context of family detention, but that private prisons in general are just not a good business, that it's simply unacceptable for American society to have prisons be privately owned.
It's ridiculously unacceptable. I 150% agree with you. So, listeners, we have a mass incarceration problem. We have the highest incarceration rate in the world, and that is not a good thing because too many people are being incarcerated unfairly. And in fact, when you say you have a mass incarceration problem, I want to break it down for people. 50% of children in the United States of America have a parent who has been negatively touched by the mass incarceration system in some way or another. So this is not good. Right? This is not good for parents. It's not good for kids. It's not good for communities. And so private prisons who have an incentive to have more people locked up so they can make more money is also not good. So I have learned a lot in this campaign. First of all, I want to underscore what Morgan said. Over 500,000 people just in the past couple months made their voices heard that they do not want banks to be involved in the private prison industry. And over 100 groups, in fact, it's 109 organizations, including Morgan's organization, the Candide Group, and Real Money Moves, as well as Moms Rising, were involved in pushing banks to get out of the private prison industry. And there have been organizations who have also been working on this for years and years and years. So we have a wave of change coming forward, and we are seeing that your voice matters. You saying you will move your money matters. You're signing a petition or a letter matters. And I want you, Morgan, if you could share a little bit about Real Money Moves and that campaign with our listeners, because here's the deal. We are not done yet. There's a lot of banks out there,
Absolutely.
A lot of big banks. So we need to stay engaged. And can you share a little bit about Real Money Moves?
Sure. So Real Money Moves is a community of athletes and actors and everyday activists who come together to really take on the question of private prisons, but also look proactively at what our money is doing in the world, you know, 100% of the time. Because one of the things that we find when most of us put our money in the bank, we really don't know where our money spends the night. And that means that it's often off doing things that we wouldn't approve of, right? Whether it's funding private prisons, whether it's funding DAPL or fossil fuels more generally. And what we find is that people often don't know about community banking options and credit unions and other places where they can really sleep better at night, you know, knowing what their money is doing in the world and that it's aligned with their values. So we initially brought together a number of NFL players and then actors from Orange is the New Black, and basically committing to keep their money out of the private prison system. But a select community also committed $10 million to social investing and saying, let's make sure that our money is really proactively invested in things that we care about. There's been a Real Money Move series on Forbes that's both articles and videos that help people who are excited about thinking about, you know, how could I have my investments be more social to provide some guidance on ways to get started. And some of that can certainly be through advocacy with the big name banks, right, to help them clean up their act, but also looking at healthier places to put our money.
It's spectacular. So I'm going to go back to the domino of wins. So the first win was J.P. Morgan Chase saying, quote, we will no longer bank the private prison industry. There was much happy dancing. And this coalition of over 109 organizations is called the Families Belong Together Coalition. So a tremendous amount of organizations across a wide variety of issue areas, including fair treatment of all immigrant families, is involved in that. Because when we're talking about private prisons and we're talking about family separations, we're also talking about what's happening with kids being either incarcerated with their parents or separated from their parents in one way or another. That is also not good. The majority of Americans agree that that's not good. The polling shows that people think that is not good. So people are rising to say, hey, banks, get out of this. So J.P. Morgan Chase got out. And then we had another big win, the second big win. And do you want to share about that one, Morgan?
Yeah. So Wells Fargo, the CEO, Timothy Sloan, was recently testifying to Congress, and the fearless Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez asked about the bank's relationship with private prisons, which in the past there's been statements that they've made that have sometimes been a bit, quite frankly, contradictory. And the nice thing about having the CEO testify to Congress is that, guess what? If you testify to Congress and lie, you go to jail, right? So it's a really serious, serious context in which to ask the CEO a question. And that question was, are you financing private prisons and are you going to continue to do so? And the response that he gave was that 2 years ago, they had set the intention of reducing their relationships, which, you know, intentions are good, but we like action. And that he was able to confirm, in the case of Core Civic, that they did not participate in their most recent financing, that they exited that relationship, and that with regards to Geo Group, when their current contract runs out, that they will exit that relationship as well. Now, one of the things, you know, when you exit a relationship, right, you got to really police yourself to make sure you don't fall into the rebound. I think we still need to have clear assurance that it's not just a plan to exit a relationship, but not to initiate any new relationships, right? Once a breakup is done, it's done. So we're really excited to support them with that process and to ensure all the activists across the country who played important roles in this victory, that it's a victory that's really going to stick. But it is a victory indeed, and we're so thrilled to have had both Chase and Wells in a 2 week period say that they are not going to be supporting private prison companies. It's huge.
It's huge. And for whatever reason, I'm oddly amused by banker talk. So like having J.P. Morgan Chase say, we will no longer bank the private prison industry. I was like, whoa, I didn't even know bank was a verb like that you would normally use. But I love it. We will no longer bank the private prison industry. I want to put it, you know, up on my wall. Yay, look what they said. They will no longer bank the private prison industry as a poster. And then I love that the Wells Fargo CEO said that they're exiting their relationship. Now let's break this down a little bit for our listeners. There are two giant, massive for-profit prison companies in the United States of America that cover a lot of the private prisons, and that is Geo Group and Core Civic. And both those entities are able to keep their doors open, do their paychecks because of things like revolving loans from banks and because of the financing that they're getting from banks all along. So when you take out the banking part from the private prison industry, you're really kind of pulling the rug out from the industry itself. So that's the tactic, people. Morgan, do you want to add anything else?
Sure. So I think it's important to note private prison companies are especially vulnerable around this question of bank financing. It's not that you're just pulling out the rug. You're pulling out the floor and the foundation and everything underneath them. And it's because they're structured as real estate investment trusts, what they call REITs. And one of the features of REITs is that they're legally required to distribute 90% of their profits to shareholders, right? That means they don't have a lot of cash left at the end of the year. And when they want to make long-term investments like buying prisons, right, they have to turn to banks for that money. So if they don't have that debt, they can't operate, right? So it's especially critical to address the relationships with banks in the context of private prisons.
Yes, absolutely. So everybody, we are not done. U.S. Bank in the Washington Post this week said that they're thinking about backing off private prison funding. There's some other banks out there. We have more work to do. We are working on making this domino effect a full domino effect. We want a hat trick in the next week, Morgan. Don't you think we can maybe get that? We want to move forward. How can people move forward? What do you think?
Well, there are multiple banks who have been implicated in terms of private prison financing, from BNP Paribas to SunTrust to Citizens Bank. And the one that's probably most familiar to listeners, Bank of America. So if you bank with one of those banks, it's a good opportunity to reach out and say, hey, we saw that Wells and Chase made this great commitment to get out of private prisons. What are you doing, right? And are you equally willing to show your consumers and society that you care about human rights, that that is really part of the company's practice? So I would really be on the lookout for opportunities to engage and work with groups like Moms Rising, who have been providing great opportunities for people to get to participate as activists in this campaign. And to remind the banks, if you are with Wells and Chase, you know, certainly congratulate them on the commitment, and make sure that it's real, right? That a year from now, they're not going back and saying, well, we've rethought this and we'd like to go back to prisons. Of nope, still not acceptable. Still not acceptable to consumers and to society.
Thank you. Thank you for being on with us, Morgan. Everybody, if you want to be involved in real time, check out the hashtag Real Money Moves. Check out the hashtag Families Belong Together, or check out the hashtag Backers of Hate. We still have a lot of work to do, but the momentum is on our side. We're winning. It's the Families Belong Together Corporate Accountability Committee with over 100 organizations, including with Morgan, Candide Group, and Real Money Moves. Thank you, Morgan.
Thank you.
We're going to take a quick break. Next up, very bad news. You know you want to stick around for very bad news. We have it for you. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Breaking Through with me, Kristen Rauffing-Feiner, powered by Moms Rising on the We Act Radio Network, TuneIn's Progressive Voices Network, and many other stations across the nation. We are joined right now by Rebecca Vallis, another of the table shakers, justice seekers, and truth tellers on the show this week. Welcome, Rebecca.
Thanks so much for having me on, Kristen.
I'm so glad you're on. You and your job at the Center for American Progress are tracking the debacles of Trump and his most recent disaster that he's pushing forward is a very bad, no good, awful proposed national budget. What should everybody know about this proposed national budget immediately right now? And everybody, make sure you have your barf bag ready. What should we all know?
I appreciate that. So I think the first thing that people need to know about this budget is the backdrop here. Trump just gave massive tax cuts to the wealthiest people in this country and to the wealthiest corporations in this country to the tune of $2 trillion that just got added to the deficit. That's now what this budget is all about. He's looking for ways to go ahead and pay for those tax cuts that he just shelled out to the richest people in this country. And so the way to understand this budget is that it's basically a roadmap for all the people across this country that he wants to pay for those millionaire and corporate tax cuts. And I should note that the budget document itself, throughout the way it's written, if you actually spend time with it, you find that on page after page after page, it actually complains about how much the deficit is ballooning and skyrocketing in this country, as though this administration could possibly be unaware that it's their own tax law that I just spoke about that is itself ballooning the deficit. And so now they're turning around and saying, oh, man, we can't afford Social Security and Medicare and Medicaid and nutrition and housing and all of these things that allow people to afford a basic standard of living. That's the set of priorities that this administration is advancing. And it's worth remembering, Trump campaigned as the president who was going to fight for the forgotten man and the forgotten woman. That was the wording that he chose when he tried to tell us whose side he was going to be on. But he's shown himself at every single turn, and this budget is just the latest reminder of whose side he's really on. And it's his millionaire and billionaire friends and his wealthy cabinet who would all be helped by this budget that further gives tax cuts to the wealthy and then asks the rest of us to pay for it.
I have been appalled watching this happen. It's like Donald Trump and team think that we don't have a memory. And I'm glad you pointed it out. And I'm going to point it out again. We had the Trump tax scam where there were massive tax cuts for the very wealthy piling on to the rest of us. So we lost a lot of revenue there because of those giant tax cuts to those who already had a lot of money. And by the way, that is not how you fuel an economy, especially a consumer-based economy, in case you're wondering. And now, later, we have this plan in the national budget, which is trying to fill the holes for the tax cuts that were given to the wealthy by cutting programs that actually lift working families in America. So it's literally having working families in America pay for tax cuts for the very wealthy. That is happening, people. That is happening right now. It is the most annoying thing on the planet Earth. I have almost thrown things across the room multiple times. Can't even believe it. And this is not a small amount of money that we're dealing with here. Can you talk about the level of cuts that are being proposed by Donald Trump and his shenanigans that he's putting forward? to pay for these tax cuts that he proposed for the very wealthy? Or he passed,
absolutely,
actually, for the very wealthy. Like, what are we talking about here?
Absolutely. And you know what? I'm going to give you one really good example here that's sort of a side-by-side, right? It takes the tax cuts and then looks at them compared to how he wants to pay for it. So you were just talking, Kristen, about these tax cuts for the wealthy. Well, the tax cuts for the wealthy, specifically that the richest 1% of people in this country, cost more than the entire supplemental nutrition assistance program. That's the program that we used to call food stamps, provides nutrition assistance, very, very meager nutrition assistance to about 39 million Americans in any given month. We're talking about low-wage workers who don't earn enough to be able to put food on the table. We're talking about hungry kids and seniors and people with disabilities. And the tax cuts that the top 1% richest people in this country just got from Trump's tax law cost more than the entire food stamp program. And yet, this budget would shrink that SNAP program by literally a third. It would cut SNAP by $220 billion over the next decade, and all to pay for those tax cuts that wealthy yacht owners and people who own multiple yachts, I'm guessing, at that level of wealth.
They might even own an airplane, you know.
They might be
people.
Private jet owners, too, right?
Yeah.
You could be both a yacht owner and a jet owner. And I think at this level of wealth, that's exactly what we're talking about. But that's the kind of priorities that this budget encapsulates. It also eliminates programs like the Community Development Block Grant, which is what funds Meals on Wheels for homebound seniors. This budget would punish joblessness with homelessness by taking away rental assistance from people who are struggling to find steady work. This budget would dismantle Medicaid, a program that is absolutely essential for seniors and people with disabilities and low-income folks and kids as a source of health insurance. And it would do so by taking away health insurance from people who, again, are struggling to find steady work. So really the theme and the through line throughout this budget is just cruelty heaped on more cruelty. The cruelty really seems to be the point.
Yeah, the cruelty seems to be the point. And at the same time, the deficit is blooming, and that's also not a good thing. I mean, this is really bad math. We've got Donald Trump doing bad math, and it's bad for our economy. And I want to just spend a little minute and talk about why it's bad for the economy. The whole idea of trickle down, where you cut taxes to the very wealthy because they'll reinvest in, you know, like our economy, is not true. Actually, in fact, when Ronald Reagan tried it, we found out it was not true. We don't need to retry it now. We already know it's not true. Our GDP is 72% based on consumer spending. So when people don't have money to spend, when we can't go out and buy the things we need, the sneakers, the groceries, the clothing we need, then actually the whole economy suffers. And so when you take money out of things like SNAP, which is food stamps, then you actually hurt our economy, because that money for SNAP is immediately used and reinvested in our economy by buying things in the grocery store, which then has a trickle across effect with, you know, the whole grocery store, agriculture, all of that economy. And in fact, a Republican economist found that every $1 invested into SNAP, you get $1.73 back later because of the positive ripple effects in our economy, because it actually boosts consumer spending. So these policies are being pushed by Trump with the false idea that they will help our economy, when in fact we know they do the exact opposite. Why do you think more people don't know that the policies do the exact opposite?
You're making such an important point, Kristen. On top of making people hungrier who are struggling to put food on the table, and that's exactly what this budget would do by dismantling our largest nutrition assistance program, this is also a budget that would be an absolute disaster for the nation's economy. And when you're talking about SNAP in particular, and I really appreciate that you actually just brought up that connection between nutrition assistance and local and then the national economy, the Center for American Progress actually just put out an analysis finding that if Trump's SNAP cuts in this budget were to take effect, again, that's $220 billion cut from this really important program over the next decade. And this is a program that provides, I should note, about $1.40 per person per meal on average. Think about that as your food budget. That's the program that Trump is thinking is bloated and possibly has some level of room for cuts. If you were to actually enact Trump's cruel SNAP cuts over the course of the next decade, that would cost the national economy 2.8 million jobs. It would kill 2.8 million jobs. And just think about the ripple effect, because we would end up not just hurting local economies, state economies, the entire national economy as a result, but we would also then end up in a situation where the same people who are now out of work don't even have nutrition assistance to turn to because of the other types of cuts that Trump is trying to ram through with this budget and the way he wants to dismantle food assistance. So really, it's, again, cruelty heaped on cruelty at a point where it feels like, to read this budget document year after year, it's the cruelty Olympics.
It's the cruelty Olympics. And I want to give more perspective on that cruelty Olympics. And that is that we have a situation where 1 in 5 children in America are experiencing food scarcity due to family economic limitations, where the minimum wage is not a living wage, where people are often working more than one job and still not able to make ends meet. And yet it is in this environment, when we were just talking on with a prior guest, more than 90% of women make less than $74,000 a year, and 50% of those make less than $30,000 a year. It is in this environment that Donald Trump is eviscerating programs like food stamps. That is ridiculous. It's wrong for our families. It's wrong for our moral compass as a country. And it's wrong for our economy. It's wrong 100 trillion ways. So I'm annoyed. So what can people do? What should people be doing?
You're exactly right, Kristen. And I'm annoyed, too. I'm angry, too. Everybody should be angry, because this budget is the opposite of what the American people want. Trump has heard that loud and clear every time he's come out with these budgets every single year. And they're just a parade of broken promises. He promised not to touch Social Security or Medicare or Medicaid. He promised to fight for the forgotten man and the forgotten woman. None of those promises, maybe he meant them when he said them, maybe he didn't. It's hard to know at this point, but none of them have come true. And so at this point, I think it's time for the American people to reckon with the fact that this president, frankly, isn't on their side and is out there crusading for those people with multiple yachts and also private jets, possibly both in their backyard. So, Kristen, you're exactly right to be hitting on what is it that people can do, because getting angry is just the first step here. A lot of people talk about the budget, the president's budget, and they say, it's dead on arrival. We don't need to worry about this. It's never going to become law the way it's been written. And that's true. It's not going to be enacted in its current form and never is. But that being said, this budget is the clearest statement that we ever get of this president's priorities. And it includes a whole range of policy proposals that we know he's not actually trying to get done through legislation. He's trying to ram through by fiat every which way. We've been watching him do that on the healthcare front. He tried to repeal the Affordable Care Act. He tried to dismantle Medicaid. He tried to do all of that through legislation, and he failed to do it legislatively, turned around, spent the last year and a half or so trying to sabotage both with every possible lever of power that he has in the White House and some that he doesn't have, that some people have been saying might actually be illegal and unlawful. He's now doing the very same thing when it comes to SNAP, the food stamp program. He wanted to see massive cuts in the farm bill. Those were rejected on a bipartisan basis at the end of last year. And so Trump turned right around and he said, you know what, I'm going to use the same playbook I've been using on health care. I'm going to try and take away food assistance from upwards of 750,000 Americans. That's exactly what he's trying to do right now through an administrative action. Sounds wonky, really important. It's called a proposed rule. And so folks can go to handsoffsnap.org to learn more and to raise their voices and fight back by submitting a public comment. They need to do that before April 2nd. But that's one of the examples of the types of proposals that are in this budget that have a very real chance of becoming real if we don't take action to stop them.
Everybody, handsoffsnap.org. Put in your comment. It's really easy. It sounds like it's hard to put in a comment. It's not hard to put in a comment. You can just put in, like, protect SNAP. Yay! It's very, very, very important. Remember, 1 in 5 kids in the United States of America are living in families with food insecurity happening in real time right now. So we need to make sure that we maintain SNAP. And maintaining this not only helps families, of course, it also helps the economy. I like to announce that to people because I'm so tired of this idea of handouts when I know, I absolutely know from the data and from real people that people are working hard. They are working double hard. And still, the minimum wage is a sub-minimum wage. And so we have a situation where the majority of minimum wage workers, in fact, 2/3 of minimum wage workers are women and moms. And so when you do not have enough money coming in from working hard, often over hard, then you end up in a situation where you need things like SNAP. And we need to make sure that SNAP is available. I don't know. What are your thoughts on this?
You're making a really important connection, Kristen, and that's that. A big part of why people turn to the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program and need a little bit of help putting food on the table is because their wages don't pay enough. The minimum wage, the federal minimum wage, hasn't increased in almost a decade. That's because Republicans in Congress haven't allowed minimum wage workers, our lowest paid workers in this country, to get a raise in that amount of time. Because of that, minimum wage workers have taken a pay cut equal to effectively 1 year of work, an entire year's pay over that decade, if you add it all up, and they're working for peanuts, often cobbling together 2 and 3 and 4 jobs to try to make ends meet. That's why a lot of low-wage workers end up turning to SNAP to try to feed their families and make sure that their kids are getting adequate nutrition. And so, you know, if President Trump were serious about wanting to shrink our SNAP program, the way to do that is by paying people a living wage. And if you actually were to raise the minimum wage just to $12, not even to the $15 that we know it needs to be at, and this, I note that amount because it's actually coming from some analysis that CAP did a few years back that we're in the process of updating now as we speak. But if you were to raise the minimum wage just to $12, you would save $53 billion in SNAP over the next 10 years. That is almost 4 times as much as Trump's cruel proposed rule that we were just talking about that would take away food from 750,000 people who are struggling to find work. That's how much we would save. And we would do it by making sure that workers have enough in wages to be able to afford food, as opposed to by making workers hungrier. That's what Trump's policy would do. So we know how to shrink programs that help people make ends meet. It's by making sure that they're actually able to afford to live. It's not by taking food out of the mouths of workers and kids to pay for millionaires and yacht owners' tax cuts.
Thank you so much for being on Center for American Progress. Thank you for all you do.
Thanks, Kristen.
Well, that's it for our show today. Thanks so much for tuning in as we tackle the top topics facing our nation in a way that requires a disclaimer. Here goes. Views expressed on this show are those of the individual speakers and should not be attributed to Moms Rising, to this station, or to any news or social media service that may disseminate a recording of this show to the public or to any segment of the public. That's it for our show today. We'll talk with you again next week. Thanks so much.